Hello, everyone. I'm Siri Vaith, Executive Director of CFRI, and I welcome you to our first question and answer session of 2021 on COVID-19 and cystic fibrosis with Dr. Rick Moss. This is an extraordinarily stressful time for our community and for our nation. And I want to remind people that CFRI does have a wide range of programs and services that can help us cope with this during this time of stress, and many of these programs can address anxiety, depression that is related. So please go to our website and see our services. I also want to remind people information presented in this recording should not be used for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult with your physician before making any changes to your healthcare plan. As we know, information about COVID-19 and vaccines is changing rapidly. So please note all the information shared today is current today, which is Thursday, January 7th, 2021. And now on to the questions. I am extremely grateful to Dr. Rick Moss for once again sharing his time, his talent, his expertise with all of us. Dr. Moss has made major contributions in the field of CF internationally, and he is the former director of the Stanford CF Center, professor emeritus of pediatric medicine at Stanford, and he is still conducting clinical research there. And lucky for us, he's also a member of CFRI's board of directors. This has been a challenging time for us all, and we are grateful to you, Dr. Moss, for your expertise and insights as we navigate this pandemic. As in previous podcasts, we did ask our community for questions, and boy, did they deliver. We don't know if we'll get through all of the questions that have been submitted so far, but we will do our best to get through in the next 60 minutes. So welcome, Dr. Moss.
Good to see you again, virtually.
Who would have ever thought when we had our first virtual meeting in March that here we would be?
Yeah, it seems like that was a long time ago.
Yeah, a lifetime ago. So as with every podcast we've done together, we always start with the first question. What is the current report for the US and globally on the number of cases and deaths related to COVID-19?
So the data from the Johns Hopkins Center, which a lot of experts use, that aggregates worldwide and national data, shows on the planet, over 87 million people have now had this disease confirmed. And of course, many more probably had that not confirmed, with just under 2 million deaths at this point in the pandemic. The United States is still in the lead in terms of cases and deaths, with over 21 million cases and 361,000 deaths, changing very rapidly by the day. Just parenthetically, yesterday, January 6th, which is a very important day in American history, people's minds were not really on COVID, but that also happened to be the deadliest day of the entire pandemic for this country. We had over 256,000 new cases on that day yesterday, and almost 4,000 people died yesterday of COVID. So that's a kind of grim introduction to where we are.
Numbers are just staggering. It is very hard to wrap my brain around how many people that is just in our country. So of those people, how many people with CF have been diagnosed with COVID-19?
So we have our sources from, in the United States, the CF Foundation through the registry, the reporting of the CF centers, which covers 80-90% of the CF population in our country. And they actually just issued the newest data this morning. So there are now 733 reported cases of CF in the United States. 204 of those are children. A little over 100, about 104 cases have been hospitalized. Most of those are adults, 22 children. I assume that means under the age of 18. And 44 of those cases are transplant recipients. So that's a trend that we've noted from early on, that post-transplant is obviously a big risk factor for more severe disease. The good news, the numbers have gone up, but the good news is that there are still only 3 reported deaths in the United States, which is pretty remarkable. Now we have a counterpart in international study that's heavily focused in countries, although it does include some others. And they their most recent report is from December 10th, so there's a little bit of a lag there. But that had 556 cases, of which they had pretty good documentation on 234, which they put up on the website. And of note on that, about 36% of those patients documented cases, or 84 patients, were hospitalized, indicating more severe disease, but only 5% needed ICU care. And they've only had five deaths in that international report of a larger number of patients. That's 2.1%. So if you aggregate all that information, what you see is that CF patients are probably a little bit more likely to be hospitalized if they get it, but do very well. And it's probably due to the fact that most of the cases in CF are younger than the general population. It's in that 18 to 30 group that has actually the highest number of CF cases, distinguished from the regular population where it skews much older. And the lung function of the patients that are being reported is generally pretty good. It's been overall over 70% is the majority, 70% predicted. So by and large, patients with more severe CF, I think, are just hunkering down a little bit, you know, more stringently than even people without, you know, advanced disease, and are avoiding getting sick and getting exposed. That's my take on it.
Fascinating. Well, we certainly took this seriously from day one as a community. So it doesn't surprise me the numbers are lower, but what a relief to see the outcomes are not as dire as we first assumed. So now we're all talking about vaccines. And so question, how many vaccines are currently available in the US? Are there other vaccines available in other countries? And what are the main differences between them and how they work in the body? And I'm just going to throw everything out at you and we can retreat if we need to. But of course, a key part of that is, what is mRNA and how is this working with these vaccines?
Yeah. Say that's a pretty big question, covers a lot of territory. Let's start in the US. There are two vaccines which have been authorized for emergency use, which is not a full approval. It means that they're getting it out quickly due to the crisis and collecting data as we go along. So we're building a database on efficacy and safety. In the clinical trials that were used for the FDA to make these authorizations, both vaccines had an efficacy of about 95%, which is absolutely spectacular. We rarely see that in vaccines. Think about the flu vaccine. There are some years where less than 50% efficacy with the annual flu vaccine. So this is very, very encouraging. In the rest of the world, yes, there are lots of other vaccines being produced, and lots of trials. There are now 19 phase 3 trials of different preparations. One that people here have heard of, I think, a lot is the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine, which is a different vaccine from the Pfizer and the Moderna products. Different, it's made a different way. And that has lagged a little bit in terms of authorization from the FDA, although that may come soon. It's now been authorized in the United Kingdom and several other places around the world. So that is being rolled out. The advantage of that vaccine is practical. It does not need cold storage, so that it is much more easy to push it out into less developed areas of the world. Both the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines require refrigeration, and in Pfizer's case, deep refrigeration. We're talking minus 60 to 80 centigrade, which is a very deep freeze. And the Moderna still needs a freezer rather than just a refrigerator. So there are logistical issues in terms of the storage of these vaccines, and you have to use them quickly once you take them out of cold storage. But so far, I can tell you that in the United States, the CDC actually today reported that 5.9 million people have been vaccinated, and 16 worldwide, with the U.S., these two vaccines plus some others, primarily Chinese vaccines and a Russian vaccine that have also been approved in those countries. Now, the government had a goal of getting 20 million people vaccinated by the end of 2020. So we're less than a third of the way there, overdue. And everyone's now aware that there are issues with the rollout that have to do with, again, federal oversight and planning and so forth. It's been left to states and in many cases, counties and even individual hospitals in terms of how they're going to get the vaccine into people's arms. And we can talk about that more, but it's a big problem. So that's basically where we stand. Now, as to mRNA, mRNA is part of the genetic code of this virus. People are familiar with DNA being the genetic code of people and other more advanced organisms, but viruses can also reproduce using RNA DNA. And what this amazing technology does is to take a portion of that code and basically scale it up into industrial quantity and put it into people's arms, embedded in a sort of fatty globule that holds it together. So the shot you're getting contains RNA for a piece of the vaccine, a very small piece of that of the virus that codes for a part of the virus that latches on to your cells. And that's called the spike protein. And people have, like, that's the corona that's on the virus. So it's a small portion of that. And that is the portion that basically allows the virus to get into cells. So if you can make antibodies to that, you can block that process. And that's why they're so effective. That's where we are now with the mRNA vaccines.
So the one that does not, the Oxford one that does not need to be so cold, is the effectiveness, it's not nearly as effective as the Pfizer and Moderna, is that true?
Well, there's been a bit of confusion about that. I think some of this had to do with how this information was made public. A lot of the information comes out first as a press release from the company. And then if you're lucky, you see a preprint, which is a scientific paper that has not been peer-reviewed. And then finally, a peer-reviewed journal where it's been vetted and thoroughly examined. So it goes through several stages of presentation. The Oxford AZ vaccine has some issues in terms of the fact that the efficacy appeared to be lower when the full dose was given. But they, in some people, during the trials, they got actually a lower dose for the first one. It also needs a booster shot. But the people that got a lower dose and then the booster actually had more protection than the people that got two full doses. So they've actually modified the dosing scheme because of that information. So that's kind of a little bit of serendipity. And there are immunological reasons for that, but that basically is what's going on. It's also, I think, playing into the fact that the FDA is taking more time in looking at that vaccine before it does an emergency use authorization. But I do think we're moving towards that pretty rapidly. And so we'll probably soon have three vaccines. And there are others that are being tested now, including in the United States. For example, Johnson & Johnson has a vaccine that's also in clinical trials, and several other companies also. So the point is that we're going to have a lot of different vaccines. They won't all be made the same way. They won't all work the same way. But if they pass a certain bar, FDA set the bar pretty relatively low at 50 to 60% efficacy. I don't know if that'll change given how well the RNA vaccines work. So we'll have to see if that's a moving target. But it's likely that we'll have a number of different vaccines. And now that the disease is so far out of control in the population, speed and getting these things out seems to be the top priority. So the more vaccines, the better, as long as they work well enough to provide a reasonable degree of protection.
I don't know if you saw the article about the little town of Ukiah, Northern California, had a broken freezer. So randomly, it was like anybody in the store got a vaccination because they don't want to waste them.
The pharmacist in Wisconsin, who is a conspiracy theorist,
yes,
took doses out of the refrigerator there and let them go bad and spoiled about 500 doses. Yes. All kinds of human behavior as well as natural variances and mishaps. And it's only good, this is going to keep happening. We just have to kind of grin and bear it and push ahead.
Right. So in terms of eligibility to get the vaccine, what are the tiers of COVID-19 vaccine eligibility, and when will vaccines be made available, if you know, to the CF community and their families and or caretakers?
Okay, so this is a pretty confusing topic. What happened was the CDC has an advisory committee. They call it the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. And they gave recommendations to the CDC, which the CDC looked at, accepted, and put out there in December, basically talking about what they call two phases, but actually it's four phases. They have a 1A, 1B, 1C, and then phase two. And we're now in phase 1A, so the earliest phase, which involves two types of people, healthcare personnel and long-term care facility residents. Now, it turns out that there are about 21 million healthcare personnel in the country. So right off the bat, there's a huge target population, and then about 3 million long-term care facility residents, not the staff, by the way, just the residents. So the idea is to try and get those people vaccinated first. It's important to remember these are recommendations. Other things can happen depending on who got control of the vaccine, but most of the states that it's been distributed to are taking this guidance. Phase 1B, the next phase, are what they call frontline essential workers. And there are various definitions of that. That's one group, that's another 30 million people, and people 75 years old and older. That's another about 20 million people. So the phase one, a very large group. Then we get to phase 1C. And here's where we can approach CF, because there are several subgroups in phase 1C. People between 65 and 75, people that are adults, they make that 16 to 64 with high risk medical conditions. Now, why 16? That's the lower age of approval for the emergency use authorizations for both the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines. So these are the two vaccines that are likely to get to people with CF first within phase 1C. And the age range pretty much covers the older CF population, not the pediatric population. There are about 30 million people between 65 and 75 years of age, and there's over 80 million people 16 to 64 years of age that have high-risk medical conditions. It's a pretty substantial chunk of the entire population. CF is in there as a little dot within that giant circle. So that's something to remember. So people with CF, their families, their providers are going to be, I think, elbowing a little bit to get at the vaccine once the rollout to phase 1C occurs. And that's likely to come sometime, another at least a way, maybe 2 months away, just based on the scale up and the rollout and the availability of the vaccines. Phase two is really everybody else who's over 16 years. And while this is happening, there will also be pediatric trials that have started between the ages of 12 and 18, so or 16. So that group will probably be added as soon as those trials are have enough data in them to justify an emergency use or authorization. So that's the tier system. It'll depend on which tier you're in. CF is going to be in that 1C, and then within that, what is going on very locally in your state, in your county, at your local medical center, or at your doctor's office, or whoever's distributing the vaccine at that point.
So I think you answered the next person's question, which is, will there be a risk stratification? So for people who have CF, but they may be a certain age, or they might have another health condition as well, this is where it teases out to one's own healthcare provider to make these decisions about priorities? Is there any guidance?
I think that's fair. And I think just in terms of intuitive thinking about this, the people at the highest risk within the CF population, to my mind, would be people that have had transplants and those with lower baseline lung function, more advanced disease. I don't know if it's going to work that way. That's a sort of ethical approach, but it may not be the most practical approach.
So will the adult and children's CF clinics be vaccinating once they're available to us, or will we need to go through our general practitioner or some other vaccination site? Are CF centers expecting to be providing the vaccine?
Well, I can't answer, for generally, but my thinking is that the vaccine is going to be mainly given through hospitals and large multi-specialty practices. So I think what people with CF need to do is be in touch with their CF center, see what's happening in terms of accessibility, realize that if you ask for it today, you're not going to get it because we're still in phase 1A, but keep your eye on the ball in terms of where your particular locality is in terms of availability. And then once it's available, my guess is you won't get it through your CF clinic. You'll probably get it through a central immunization site. So for example, at Stanford Hospital, there's one place where everybody's being immunized now. So you have to go to that place to get it. And once it gets beyond, and that's mainly for the healthcare workers, that work within the system. Once we get beyond that, I think there will be pharmacies. They've talked about Walgreens and Rite Aid, also being CVS, possibly being places we go in and get the vaccine. So it's just a question of staying on top of the news and seeing when it's available. And if needless to say, I do recommend that everybody with CF eligible, that is at least 16 years of age, go and get that one of the two vaccines.
And with the categories, was there any conversation about caregivers? If a person with CF, a child with CF, teenager has the vaccine, but parents, siblings don't have it, was there any kind of thought about including it as a family system or no?
I'm not aware of that. I could be wrong, but I think it's restricted to the actual individuals rather than either household members or caregivers at this point. Again, we're dealing with a bottleneck of supply. And that bottleneck is going to be with us for probably several 3-4 months more. So until we have a lot larger supply, which may mean more vaccine use authorizations for other vaccines like the Oxford vaccine, there's going to be a bottleneck in terms of getting this out to these large eligible populations on the tier system.
And you had mentioned in terms of prioritizing the people with transplants may be ahead of the line there. So we did have a question. Will it be effective for post-transplant patients? Is there a risk to taking it if I am immunosuppressed?
There should be no risk to the vaccines to immunosuppressed people. What we don't know is whether their response will be as vigorous. So I don't think it's a safety risk. I think it's more of not knowing if the efficacy will be as high as it is. We do know, for example, that there is somewhat less efficacy in very old people who've gotten the vaccines compared to people that are somewhat younger. So as the immune system changes, yes, the ability to respond to the vaccine may suffer. But in terms of the risk being higher, I still think that's a high priority for people that have had transplants to be among the first patients with CF to be eligible to get it and go get it.
And just to restate, this is not a live vaccine. So anybody who has been told they should not have a live vaccine is eligible to use these mRNA therapies.
That's correct. All the trials in the United States, current or planned, to my mind, do not involve either live or killed or live attenuated vaccine. They're all either mRNA vaccines or various kinds of subunit vaccines, protein vaccines. So none of this is infectious. There's no risk of getting COVID from the vaccine. Now, that's an important point. You can still get sick because you can get sick before. It takes several weeks on a booster shot. So it's probably at least a month to 6-week process to be immunized. And in that 6 weeks, you can still be and still get sick and still get the disease. And so you may read on social media that somebody got the shot and got sick the next day. Well, yeah, they were exposed 6 7 days before that. They didn't know that. So this is something to keep in the back of mind.
Keeping the thread going, you had just talked about it not being a live vaccine and that about people having the side effects from the vaccine. I think that's what's so confusing for everybody too, is that the symptoms of COVID are all over the map. So no one's going to know, but yes, this is not because of the vaccine. So everybody should remember that. The next question, and all these are somewhat linked. Somebody wrote in, my 22-year-old son has CF. He has very low lung function, below 30% FEV1, and is oxygen dependent. Someone in medicine mentioned to us that getting the vaccine with such low lung function could be dangerous. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, of course, we don't have information yet on that represents actual clinical, you know, data. But I would say that the risk to that person is higher if they don't get vaccinated than if they do. In other words, the risk of catching the disease and having a bad outcome is much higher than the risk of side effects from the vaccine. Remember, the vaccine won't give you the disease, and it may well protect you from getting it. So I would say to that person that they should try and get hold of it when it's available.
The next question, if I've had COVID, do I still need to get the vaccine?
Right, that's an interesting one. I would say the answer to that is yes. I've heard Dr. Fauci also comment about this, saying that he would recommend doing that. And the reason for that is that natural infection provides protection, but it may wane fairly quickly. And we're still learning about this as we collect more information. But studies of people that have had the disease suggest that the antibodies that are protective may start to fade after a few months. And therefore, you can get the disease again. And there have been well-documented cases of reinfection, that is a second infection with COVID after the first one. So knowing that, we also don't know exactly how long the protection from the vaccines will last. So we're still in a sort of black hole of information about the longer term protection issue. But it makes sense once you've recovered from whatever severity, you know, you might've been asymptomatic, just test positive, you might've gotten sick, you might've gotten very sick. I would still say once you've recovered, you should go ahead and get vaccinated.
That does raise an interesting question. How will we know? Is it a tracking of antibodies with millions of people that have been vaccinated that we know if there's an ongoing need for boosters?
That's a very complicated question because tracking that is affected by the fact that people in trials would have to be followed out in their original randomization to get a very crisp idea about that. And yet people who are on the placebo arm, imagine you were in the Pfizer trial back in March or April, and you got the placebo, you didn't get the vaccine, but now you know that you got the placebo. I think you'd still want to get the vaccine. So Pfizer has recently announced that they're going to offer people in the placebo arm who got treated before the end of March, coming March, will then be eligible to get a live vaccine, a real vaccine. So we kind of lose that ability to follow long term, but it makes sense to go ahead and treat people that were, you know, altruistic enough to volunteer for a trial where they had a 50% chance of getting a placebo. And everybody in the CF world has been in a drug trial, has been through this, been to that dance. So it's something that that we should do. I think most people agree with that. But how long the immunity lasts is a big open question. Another complicating factor to that is the emergence of these variants, which may be more transmissible and therefore may change the odds of getting the infection.
I'm going to swing back to the question about the variants. But before I do that, in light of the baby boom that is happening in many CF centers due to after use of Trikafta, we've had several questions about the safety of the vaccine for pregnant women, and in particular, women with CF.
So we don't have answers on that. The CDC guidance is to discuss this with your provider. It's a little squishy, right? So when you don't have information, you kind of just make a personal decision about that. I think based on the overall safety profile, it's probably going to be okay. And there are trials that are including pregnant women going on now. We just don't have those answers yet. And similarly for the 12 to 17 age group. Hopefully within the next few months, there actually will be solid information about that, at least for some of the vaccines, particularly the two mRNA vaccines.
And even not CF specific, remind me, how are the outcomes or impacts on women who have had COVID while they're pregnant?
So far, that has not been a safety signal at all. So most people are very optimistic that that's not going to be a problem. Now, there is one thing that has gotten a lot of press that I should mention, and that is the allergic reaction issue. Both of the two mRNA vaccines now have reported cases of what's called anaphylaxis, which is an immediate allergic reaction, which can be very serious, can be life-threatening. Unfortunately, it's very rare, extremely rare, about 11 cases per million for the Pfizer vaccine, less than 2 cases per million for the Moderna vaccine, but fewer people have gotten that now, so that may even out. Both of those are higher numbers than we see with the flu vaccine, which is about 1 per million, 1.5 per million. Still, though, if you think about that, 11 cases per million people, that's still a very minuscule number. But that is the reason why when you get your shot, you're asked to stay around for 15 minutes at the facility where they can treat you if you do have a significant allergic reaction. Again, extremely rare, but possible.
A good reminder, because I know many people, I won't say about myself, who get the flu shot and they're like, will you stick around for a while? I'm like, sure, so this is a good reminder to everybody. So next question, swinging back to the variant, how is the new COVID strain different from the original strain? What is the predicted impact on the number of infections and deaths? And are the current vaccines effective against this new strain?
Again, that's becoming a complicated question. So it's important to start by knowing that these viruses mutate all the time. That comes from errors in the replication process. So every month, there's a couple of switches in the what's called the nucleotide, the sequence in the RNA. Almost all of them are harmless and don't create any change in how the virus behaves. But in the late summer and early autumn in England, they noticed a strain that seemed to be highly transmissible. And when they looked at the sequence, they found that this was a new strain that had accumulated a large number of mutations, 17 mutations, which is unusual. And 8 of those were in the spike region, the region that involves the binding, both the binding to the cells and the place where antibodies work. And what they then found in testing this variant, which they called the B117 variant, is that it appears to be more transmissible. That is, it seems to get into cells more easily. And it spreads from person to person more easily. So if you do get infected, you're liable to get a higher dose of it when you get infected. So it doesn't seem to create more severe disease, as far as we know. But it's much more easily spread, which is actually more dangerous because it means if it created more severe disease, it would be simply a sort of straight mathematical 1 + 1 + 1 problem, each person getting sicker. With it being more transmissible, that means that it has 50 to 70% more likelihood of spreading to another person. That means more people become infected and it becomes an exponential increase rather than an arithmetic increase in cases. So that's why there's been this very large degree of alarm, particularly in the UK, but now also in many other countries where it's been detected, and we've now found it in the United States. We're doing less sequencing here in the States than is being done in some other places around the world. But the CDC has also said that they're ramping up the number of sequencing tests that they're doing weekly. So that now that's about 3,000, they want to go to about 6,000 samples sequenced a week to really track this better. But this so-called UK variant has spread around the world now and is likely to take over. Just as an earlier version called the G614 version took over back in March or April, which also had a higher transmission rate than the original strain from Wuhan, China. So we're seeing natural evolution, and some of these changes are making some functional impacts. In terms of the response to the vaccines and the antibody efficacy, there's no signal yet that that's creating a problem, but it could happen. There's an even newer strain now from South Africa, which has a particular mutation that may be closer to the place on the spike that actually is responsible for the binding and where the best antibodies are focused. So this may turn out to be more of a problem. So there's a two levels of problems. One is to reduce transmission, we have to stick to the public health measures, since this is a more transmissible strain that is, I think, almost certain to take over and become the dominant strain if it hasn't already. And then the possibility that the vaccines may not work as well. No sign of that yet, but it's entirely possible. If that does happen, it's not going to be that difficult to play with the vaccine code to adjust it. So people are still relatively optimistic that even if there are mutations, that we're not going to get to a point where the vaccines don't work.
Well, you proactively answered some of the next questions. But one last one related to that, with this more contagious strain, is it true that the herd immunity ratio must now be greater than 75% before we can begin to resume our large gatherings?
Yeah, unfortunately, the higher the transmissibility, it's likely that you need to get closer to a higher number. So I know that Dr. Fauci has said we're talking now maybe 80, 90% to get to herd immunity with this new strain, which makes the job tougher.
Yes, because look where we are now from people not being able to follow those guidelines before. So the next question, remember all those times we had these Q&As and it was all about antibodies? Nobody talks about antibodies much anymore. So somebody did ask, where are we with antibody testing? Was there ever a test that was found to be the accurate test? And if so, how do we get tested?
So the antibody tests, the problem here, and this is also true to some degree with the PCR test, the detection of the virus test. The antibody test, remember, doesn't detect the virus. It detects your body's immune response. So it's a good test to see whether you've been infected or not, because if you got infected, you will develop antibodies. However, those antibodies will wane with time, may go away. So it depends when you got infected also. In terms of the tests themselves, there are lots of different tests that have been authorized now for emergency use by the FDA. And knowing how good the test is at where you might get tested would involve questioning and maybe doing a little homework to get the answer, because there's so many out there. I can tell you that there are three very large companies that make very good tests. Abbott is one, Siemens is another, and Roche is another. They're very big biopharmaceutical companies, and they make a high throughput, you know, testing that's extremely accurate, you know, in the range of 98-99%. So if you ask your provider what test is used at the lab that I'm going to get tested in, and you find out it's one of these three, the odds are that, and in the United States, mostly it's the Abbott and Roche tests that are used in most places. Now it can vary. At Stanford, for instance, they're using an in-house system that involves one commercial system and then two in-house systems. And Stanford actually has three different levels of antibody testing. So it's and that's because there's a lot of research around it. For normal purposes, you just get one test. And, you know, even in a research setting, it's just one blood draw, but they can do several levels. And if you're doubtful about the result, you run the second or third test also. That being said, it's not an easy thing to get an answer to if you just go in to your CF center or your doctor and say, I can I get an antibody test? Which one is it going to be? Why would you want to ask about that? Well, if you know that you've been exposed, you know, if you test positive, you're going to want to know at some point later how robust your response was. So that'd be one reason to check it out. If you don't know if you've been exposed, the best test is probably just to get a PCR test to see, or an antigen test, which is another test for detection of the virus, to see if you've actually been infected or not. Most of the testing is being done to look at this question of how robust is the response, which antibodies are best to use, and how long do they last? These are sort of research questions that are ongoing. We now know that the best test is probably something called the neutralizing antibody test, which is much more complicated because it tests the functional ability of that antibody to stop the virus from getting into cells. But there are surrogates for that, which are also very good, that are involved in simply looking at that same region and using a very precise type of test to see if you have antibodies to that region, which would probably mean they're neutralizing, and the correlation is very good.
Sorry, the questions keep coming. And I have more here that were submitted and more in the Q&A box, but seasonal flu. I remember you had said months ago, everybody get your flu shot. So now that we're further in, many of the vulnerable are staying home to avoid exposure to COVID. And I'm concerned that the flu shot rates will be much lower this year. And tied with that, and we can back it up if you want, how much protection does the seasonal flu shot provide against COVID-19? Should we consider getting a booster shot for the flu if we're not expected to receive the COVID-19 vaccine for some months?
Yeah, flu shots have been going up over the past several years in terms of the percent of people that have been getting immunized. This particular year, I don't think the data has been collected. Flu rates have been very low. People suspect that's because of the response to COVID, that people have getting much less exposure to flu, as well as some other respiratory viruses. So there's not a lot of data on this year's flu vaccine. We've strongly recommended that people continue to get their annual flu vaccines. So if you haven't gotten that yet, you should still get it, because we don't know if this flu season is going to linger around. But so far, the rates have been very low indeed.
Somebody asked, can you still transmit the virus after you've been vaccinated?
For a period of time, definitely yes, until the vaccine and the booster take effect. Once you've actually developed your own immunity, we don't know the answer to that yet. That has to be studied. People are acting cautiously and saying, look, you should continue to use the public health measures, the masking, the social distancing, the hand washing, even if you've been vaccinated, because we don't yet have an answer to whether or not you can still carry the virus. There's some optimism that these vaccines are good enough to halt the transmission, you know, so you don't get infected at all. But what we know so far from these trials is disease, not so much asymptomatic infection. So hang in there.
Is there any data available regarding commonalities found amongst the 5% not protected by the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines?
I'm not aware of any information about that. The rates of non-protective levels of antibodies is lower in people that are over 65 than below, but marginally so. It's still well worth it for older folks to get the vaccine. That's about all we can say about that.
Is there any reason to wait for a certain type of vaccine? I mean, obviously this is in the future when hopefully there are more options available at once.
Yeah, that's a really good question. It gets back to the supply and demand issue. At this point, with the demand so much greater than the supply, anything that gets an emergency use authorization in the United States is going to be good enough to go out and get as soon as it's available. It's possible you may get something that is not as good as something that comes later. But I can tell you, for having the very first two with rates of 95% efficacy, that's a very high bar. So if anything, we're going to see further vaccines that are less effective. And those are most likely to go to other places in the world because the first priority of these two mRNA vaccines is in the United States where they're being manufactured.
From the Q&A box, it looks like we've already addressed most of the questions. There is one: with the growing presence of the new variant of the virus, is it safe to go to the grocery store by wearing a mask and a face shield?
Yes, I think the important point here is to keep doing the same public health measures. There's no reason to believe that the variant has different properties in terms of how it's spread. The issue is what happens once it encounters the inside of your nose. So, you know, if you're wearing the mask and a face shield's great to add to that if you want, but certainly a good mask with a good fit, that's really important. Probably the most important thing, along with trying to keep that distance. So those are the important things. And of course, the hand washing once you leave the store. A lot of stores now, you know, you can wash your hands on the way out. They have little dispensers there. So I think there's nothing that needs to change. It's really a question of making sure that you persist.
Well, this, I think we have come to the end of this list. Let's hope there's one more. For those on Trikafta or any other CFT or modulator, should we be concerned about any interactions with the drugs and the vaccine?
Well, I doubt it. The registry is collecting information on vaccinations, and eventually there'll be information about any effect of any of the CF drugs on either efficacy or safety, but there's really no reason to believe that any of them would have any interaction or drug effect. It's important to remember that this mRNA has a temporary effect on the production of that spike, and that once you produce the antibodies, the whole thing is gone. So it's a temporary effect specific to the immune system that shouldn't really have any interaction with any of the drugs that are used, including, and most importantly, Trikafta.
Well, we are coming up to the end of the hour. You have been incredible with the wide range of questions that we've thrown at you, and you've been able to answer them all. So do you have any closing remarks for all of us?
Well, I do think it's important to be informed about the news of where we are in the distribution and not to jump the line, but to be ready to move once it's reached that phase, that 1C phase, where people with conditions, adults with conditions, are eligible to get vaccinated. And the only reason to delay until then is really to get those frontline people vaccinated so the healthcare system doesn't collapse, so that we continue to get our groceries, et cetera. And then as soon as people in those categories can be vaccinated, it may be time to step up and get the vaccine as a CF patient, and hopefully soon after that, a caregiver or family member. Let me make one last comment, which is that there is some talk now about, given the urgency of distributing the vaccine, people are starting to look at ways to perhaps give more people the vaccine by either skipping that second dose, waiting longer, or in the case of the Moderna vaccine, actually giving half the dose to certain categories.
No answers on that. These things are under discussion, but I thought I'd throw it out there because you may see big changes in the vaccine schedule or dosing as a result of those discussions. In the United Kingdom, they've already made the decision to allow people to mix and match. So get one vaccine and then another for the booster. And the FDA so far has said, no, we're not going to do that here in the States. Who's right? We don't know. The science certainly is on the side of sticking with what we got, but you got the urgency on the other side. And you know, when almost 4,000 people die in one day from this disease here, you can be sure that there's a lot of urgency involved. And I think, you know, once January 20th occurs and the new administration comes in, there's going to be some major changes that we will need to keep track of in terms of how the whole program is being handled at the national level.
And currently with the FDA, they're recommending there are no changes to the protocol for now, right? Not mix match, no halving, no longer periods, just stay the course for this whole new territory.
That could change. I'm just putting it out there as a possibility.
Well, I am so grateful to you, Dr. Moss, for sharing your time with all of us. I'm grateful to everybody who presented their questions to us, who attended today. I don't want to put you on the spot, but hopefully we can count on you to come back in a few weeks because it's just such a quickly evolving situation. And it's just so wonderful to have a knowledgeable person to ask our CF-related questions to.
Okay, I'll take you up on that.
Okay.
2 weeks, we got to survive those first.
Yes, we do. So thank you. Thanks to everybody. Please stay safe and we will see each other soon virtually. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.